Okay, good morning, everyone. Thanks again for joining us on this Friday morning for our In Conversation With call series. We appreciate your support and jumping on the phone with us this morning. And I'm now going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Thanks, Pam. And I want to thank everybody for joining us today. We're finally returning to something that is a semblance of more normal activity. We are ramping up research that's not only COVID-related research, but other research. And our health system continues to do well, and the number of cases continue to fall. In fact, as of the last couple of days, less than 50 patients in the Montefiore Health System with COVID. This is with a caution warning here. We need to continue to be vigilant because this is occurring despite the fact that the numbers in the U.S. continue to rise. And it's not just positive tests. The number of hospitalizations, the number of ICU admissions continues to be problematic in many parts of the country. So not only do we need to be vigilant, we also need to be prepared, understand what we did the last time, be ready for a second surge if that comes. And if it comes, it's likely to be later in the fall when influenza is a problem. And I would urge all of you to make sure that you're vaccinated for influenza this flu season, because the combination of the two is likely to be bad. We continue to work on clinical trials on COVID, mostly the follow-up components of that, including the second version of remdesivir, the convalescent plasma, and some of the other immunomodulatory drug trials. We're also initiating an interesting study of Montefiore Medicine Associates to try and sort out what is a really important question in our minds. That is, who of those who've developed antibodies are actually truly protected from reinfection? We have a number of associates at Montefiore who we've been following prospectively. A large number of them actually have been infected and have antibodies. A number of others have had antibodies found but never did have a symptomatic infection. We'll be following those folks prospectively to try and figure out whether or not they're truly protected. There are a number of laboratories that continue to work on biological therapies, including antibodies and cells to treat the infection or to treat the overactive immune response associated with COVID. In fact, at Wednesday's internal seminar series on COVID, I heard an interesting talk from Dr. Chandran, who's working on a series of antibodies that may be particularly active and described as serologic test as well. There are a number of other laboratories working on small molecules that might inhibit the virus. And we're lucky to have Dr. Vern Schramm with us today, who might be able to help us learn a little bit more about that in just a few minutes after I introduce him. But I think it's important to keep in mind that despite the fact that there are a number of vaccines in development, that's still going to take some time. So the search for acute therapeutics, I think, is really important, not only for treating patients now, but as part of an overall preparation plan for a second surge, should that occur in the fall or later, before a protective vaccine is available. So let me move on. It's really a delight today to have one of the true leaders of Einstein here today with us. Dr. Vern Schramm is the Ruth Mernz Chair in Biochemistry. He's a professor of biochemistry, and he's a lead thought leader in the area of drug development, drug design, and inhibition, particularly inhibition of enzymes, and has developed several novel therapies. His lab has developed several novel therapies to treat a host of diseases. So I hope that he'll be able to talk to us a little bit today about not only what he's doing, but what the prospects are for, in fact, therapeutic development in COVID-19. So Vern, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, both you and the Office of Development. It's a pleasure to be able to talk about our research. Asking any scientist to talk about their research is a little like asking parents to talk about their children. So Gordon, I hope you can cut me off at the appropriate time. We often hear about tales of serendipity in science and in discovery, and certainly what I'm going to tell you today is one of them. Our research for many years has just been to satisfy our curiosity and the curiosity of the scientific field into how enzymes work. And answering that question in our laboratory has led us to galidesivir, which is a new antiviral now in clinical trials for COVID-19 in Brazil. And I'm going to tell you that path all the way from our scientific curiosity to a new antiviral. So what are enzymes? Enzymes are biological catalysts, and they increase the rate of chemical reactions billions and trillions of times above what would happen without them. Our human cells are really full of enzymes. In fact, all living things are full of enzymes, and their job is to convert what we eat into what we are. It's incredible how constant the materials inside of cells are and how inconstant our diet is. So every cell has thousands of these proteins that make all the essential chemical conversions from our foodstuffs or our food molecules to molecules of life. And they do it at incredible speeds. Without enzymes, there would be no life. So this was an early evolution in the biological world. Understanding exactly how enzymes do this incredible job has been a central question of biomedical science. We spent many years trying to understand exactly what happens at the heart of enzyme reaction at the instant it catalyzes its chemical reaction. Chemical reactions are chemical bonds being made or broken, and it happens at incredible speed, a few femtoseconds, faster than light can travel even the width of a hair. So it's very difficult to try to understand that step, but we've done that, and we've done it by a combination of experimental approaches and computational chemistry that we won't go into here. However, understanding that was a significant advance, and it's been one of the major advances of our laboratory, and it's changed the way all scientists think now about how enzymes function. So that knowledge to us was like looking into the back of a fine Swiss watch and then saying, I can see exactly how this works now. I can predict what will stop it, what will start it, how it works. And for enzymes, that means we can look into the heart of the function of an enzyme and now understand how to make an inhibitor that stops only one, the desired target, of the thousands of enzymes that are present in the cell. So that's been our extension of the understanding of catalysis. One of the enzymes we happen to be studying for this development plays an essential role in human T cell development. Now, T cells are a class of human white blood cells that fight infections. And understanding how that specific enzyme functions allowed us to design a drug candidate that we thought would be good at blocking its catalytic activity. And it would be specific for that enzyme. Now, we don't have a chemistry department at Einstein, but we have chemistry collaborators, and our collaborators at the Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, who we've been working with for over 20 years, synthesized this drug candidate for us and sent it back to Einstein. We demonstrated that it was thousands of times more powerful than any other inhibitor ever made for this drug target. And there had been dozens of attempts by major pharmaceutical companies to target this enzyme before. So Einstein licensed it to a biotechnology company. And after many years of clinical trials, that compound, the very first one we made, was approved for use against T-cell lymphoma in Japan. So this drug was really remarkable because it came from fundamental research, and was also the first drug developed at Einstein to be approved for human use. And it has caused some remarkable cures of T-cell disease. This compound is now on the market in Japan. It's called Mundasine. We hope eventually it will get into other territories. That remains to be seen. But I want to pause here and just repeat again that this ability to design a new drug was not where we started on this project. We were simply motivated by curiosity about how enzymes work and how they can be so efficient at catalyzing these miraculous chemistry steps of life. So the drug design ability was really thrust on us by our unique understanding of how enzymes work. But that also caused our lab to become known to others as a drug design lab. One of our academic collaborators at the University of San Francisco School of Medicine approached us. He wanted to try to make a drug candidate for an enzyme from a protozoan parasite called Trichomonas vaginalis. Now, this parasite causes over 3 million cases a year in the U.S. of a sexually transmitted disease. It's a nuisance, it's not a killer, but it would be good to have a good therapy for it. So we studied the enzyme from Trichomonas and we made a drug candidate, and it was a superb inhibitor of the target enzyme. And when our colleague at San Francisco tested it against the parasite, it did not kill the parasite. So you could consider this a kind of a failure in one way, but a success in the other, that we had proved again that we were able to make powerful inhibitors. The enzyme that we blocked was not essential for that parasite. It had other backup enzymes to get around that step. We called this compound immucillin A, and since it didn't work for the Trichomonas target, we put it on the shelf, forgot about it, moved on to other things. In the meantime, the pharmaceutical partner that had licensed our compounds had tested all the drug candidates that we had provided to them, including immucillin A, the one we'd made for the Trichomonas, and they were trying to find out if they could discover a compound for inhibition of the hepatitis C virus. So they were throwing everything they could find at it to see if any of them had antiviral activity against the hep C. To their surprise, immucillin A, the drug candidate we'd made for Trichomonas, was effective against 20 different viruses. These susceptible viruses had one thing in common, and they were all RNA viruses. Well, what do we mean by an RNA virus? Humans, bacteria, and most viruses use DNA as the genetic information, and you know how that works. The DNA makes RNA, the RNA makes the proteins, and the proteins, of course, are the enzymes and structures that do the job to make the cells. But as the name implies, the RNA viruses use RNA as their genetic information. When they enter a human cell, they release the RNA and hijack the metabolites in the human cell to make more virus copies. However, one thing that human cells lack is an RNA copying enzyme. Viruses need to encode and make their own RNA viral polymerase. It's the only way that they can replicate. So the viral RNA copying enzyme is an Achilles heel for the virus. It's theirs alone, but human cells don't need it. And that's what immucillin A, the inhibitor, did. It acted like a Trojan horse. It gets into the cell, the viral RNA copying enzyme incorporates immucillin A into its own RNA, and that stops its replication. So that kills the virus. Now, this happened in 2014, and that was long before the COVID crisis, of course. And the RNA viruses of interest at the time included the Ebola virus, Marburg virus, yellow fever, the other coronaviruses, among others. So at the time, Ebola virus outbreaks were occurring through Africa, and the company decided they would try to enter this compound into an Ebola clinical trial if it proved safe in animals. So in animal studies, you can inject Ebola virus into primates, these are monkeys, and 48 hours later, give them a dose by injection of immucillin A, and it cures their disease. So this was remarkable and led to the FDA to approve a phase one clinical trial. In a phase one clinical trial, you look for safety in humans, and Immucillin A, which was now renamed for clinical trials by the FDA, it's now called Galidesivir. It was found to be safe in humans by injection either intramuscularly or by IV. So it was ready to go for the Ebola trial, but because of the difficulty of trying to get a controlled Ebola study, and these are true episodic diseases in Africa, I'm sure many of you read this morning that the World Health Organization has just announced that the latest Ebola outbreak in Africa has been contained today. So because of that difficulty, the company decided to conduct a phase two trial, that's looking for dosing and efficacy, in yellow fever in Brazil, another one of the susceptible viruses. In Brazil, yellow fever is endemic. It happens every summer. And they thought this would be a good entry-level clinical trial. So Galidesivir was prepared for IV injection. It's already been shipped to Brazil, ready to go for the yellow fever trial when the COVID virus struck. Now, in response, the company immediately petitioned the FDA to see if they could pivot in this yellow fever trial, and instead of enrolling only yellow fever victims, to enroll both yellow fever victims and COVID patients. So that was approved, and this trial just began a few weeks ago in Sao Paulo, Brazil. We suspect that this disease is going to go on for a long time in Brazil and in the United States, unfortunately, because of lack of control. So the trial is a double-blind, placebo-controlled study. That means that neither the clinicians nor the patients know who's getting the drug or who's getting the placebo until the trial is over. The results are then unblinded, and the results are recorded for safety, the dosing levels, the viral load reduction, and improvement in signs and symptoms, clinical manifestations, and of course, mortality. Now, this is not the only antiviral that's involved in clinical trials. Gordon mentioned remdesivir has a similar mechanism of action, and it's also in clinical trials, including in patients in the Montefiore population. So we've seen some of those results, both from Montefiore and from other locations. And the results are that there seems to be modest improvement in time to recovery using remdesivir, but the FDA has not yet approved remdesivir as an accepted clinical agent, except for trials. So more trials need to be done with this and other agents to see if we can block the COVID RNA polymerase and kill its activity. So only human clinical trials will resolve which of these agents have the most potential, and there are many of these studies going on. So I'm going to stop here, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Those I can, I'm sure Gordon can.
Well, Vern, thanks. That's a fascinating story of, as you say, serendipity. And could you repeat again whether or not Galidesivir is actually blocks the COVID, or do you know whether it blocks the SARS-CoV-2 RNA polymerase effectively?
Yes, it does. Before these studies were initiated, trials were done with the virus in cell culture to demonstrate that it protected cultured cells against the COVID-19 virus.
So that's a promising note for sure. I mean, I think, as I pointed out, waiting for a vaccine is we can't wait idly for a vaccine. We need a number of different arrows in our quiver, in our pack, to really attack this virus acutely before we have either herd immunity or induced immunity with a vaccine. So I'd ask you one other question that may be a little bit outside your expertise, but is an interesting one that's come up over the last few days. There has been some suggestion that treatment with other vaccinations, particularly the Sabin polio vaccine, might provide some protection against SARS COVID-19 and perhaps other things like influenza. Have you heard about this, and what's your
I have heard about this, and it's really interesting. These kinds of immunizations use attenuated live virus, and that means that every protein that's on that virus is an antigen for the human immune system to make antibodies. So, as you know, there's not one antibody made, there's hundreds of antibodies made to a complex organism like a virus. And it is possible that some of those antibodies might have cross-reactivity with common viral, let's say, protein sequences in other viruses. There are other mechanisms, too, that almost certainly are at play. When any virus infection occurs, or the immune response to a virus, there are interferons, for example, which affect almost all virus infections that are made by cells as a defense and released. So interferons will protect not only against the immunizing virus, but also other viruses that follow within a relatively short period of time. There's been research at Einstein showing that there are small molecules formed in response to virus infections. Steve Elmo's lab last year discovered that human cells make a hitherto unknown molecule that is a chain terminator like these compounds we've been talking about, galidesivir and others, that kill the viral polymerase. These are made in human cells in response to any virus infection, and they accumulate and also provide broader antiviral infection. So there's probably others that we don't know about, but these are at least two or three of the mechanisms that could be at play. And it seems to be real, although most of the data is anecdotal. I don't think there's been a real solid controlled study that I know of. So I think it's perhaps real, but there'll need to be more evidence, and certainly it's promising.
Well, that's terrific. I guess the one other question I would have is that these viruses are generally a population of viruses with different genetic variants within them. And one of the concerns about therapy and biologics as well as small molecule therapy is escape. The viruses are tricky and they're shifty, and they can selectively upregulate a population of virus that might be resistant to a particular therapy. What's your thought about combination therapies, either molecules designed to inhibit the same protein RNA polymerase or to different molecules as a mechanism to avoid escape?
Yes, we've learned so much from the HIV epidemic, which is now nearing control, because there any single agent rapidly led to mutations that escaped the effect of the drug. However, when both polymerase and protease inhibitors, most viruses make their own proteases that are required for processing and making new viral particles. When they're used in combination, then it's much less likely to develop resistance. So multi-drug therapy is almost certainly going to be the way to go. Unfortunately, in clinical trials, one agent needs to be approved at a time. And once the single agents are approved by showing some efficacy, then they can be combined for a third clinical trial. So this will have to happen if we want the acute phase agents to be effective for COVID. And I'm hoping that will happen as rapidly or even more rapidly than it did for the HIV pandemic.
Great. Well, Vern, I want to thank you for joining us, providing your insights. It's a fascinating story about galidesivir, hopefully one that's going to have a happy ending for everybody, meaning effective against this virus. I want to also thank everybody for joining us today. And we will not have a call next week because of the 4th of July holiday, but everybody have a happy and safe 4th. And again, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you all for attending.